The movie Always Be My Maybe on Netflix starts with a young Sasha Wong coming home from school to an empty house with a couch covered in protective plastic.
Hi, Daddy and I working late at the store again. Make yourself dinner and don't watch TV.
Someday, Sasha will be a celebrity chef. For now, she's a preteen in a turtleneck. She stands on a chair to get what she needs. Spam and rice, a sprinkling of fish flakes, and a paper umbrella to make it look pretty. She's just begun eating her dinner in front of the TV when her friend Marcus comes over. He, too, wears a turtleneck.
You want some soup? My mom said to ask if you wanted some soup. She makes way too much. Then I have to bring the leftovers to school in a thermos. Nobody wants to sit next to that kid with the thermos soup. Only the other kids with the thermos soup. And I don't want to sit next to those losers.
Always Be My Maybe is a totally mainstream, all-American rom-com. Both romantic leads are Asian American. They start as childhood friends, and they go through the whole on-again, off-again, love-to-hate-you story romantic leads always go through. They're friends, then they're more than friends, then they hate each other, then they're drawn back together, and all is finally right in the world. Hey, it's a formula for a reason. It totally works. And for people who have never seen their own intimate experiences portrayed in this way on screen, it's a milestone. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Always Be My Maybe is getting the screen time treatment on KCUR's Central Standard. Call 816-235-2888 to join the discussion. As always, this entire segment comes with a big fat spoiler alert. My guests today are a stand-up comic, a literary scholar, and a movie critic, and you at 816-235-2888. Anthony Shifei Shu of the UMKC English Department, good morning.
Good morning.
Tony Vinn is originally from Kansas City. Now he's working in L.A. as a stand-up comic. He's been called the Asian Chris Rock, though I'm not sure by whom. It just says so on his website. Tony Vinn, hello.
How are you doing? I thought I was the Asian scholar or the literary scholar. So,
if you want to be, that's cool.
All right.
So, first of all, could you each just give your capsule review in a few sentences? What did you think of this movie, initial reaction type stuff? Tony?
I thought it was great. I mean, I'm a big fan of rom-coms. I hate to admit it, but I loved all the classics, you know, When Harry Met Sally, Sleepless in Seattle. And so this one I thought
was like Meg Ryan.
I love Meg Ryan and Tom Hanks. I want to see them back together again. But I thought this one was like delightful. It was cute and it was just a fun, entertaining movie. And I enjoyed it a lot.
Anthony?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really interested in terms of it being kind of the next wave of Asian American productions. I'm so used to indie film and TV shows that get canceled really quickly. And so what was interesting to me is just kind of thinking about it in terms of maybe its larger cultural import at this moment, right? It was kind of astounding in some ways.
Astounding in what ways?
Well, I mean, you have, you know, two Asian Americans that are both the, you know, love interests of each other, right? So you don't have any kind of mediation by white characters. In fact, there's only one, I believe, in the film. And so it's a film that's pitched towards both an outside and inside conversation, which I found fascinating.
Okay, we're going to come back to this. But what do you think the movie does in its portrayal of Asian Americans in pop culture that's different from what you've seen before? What stands out to you, Anthony?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing is just having an Asian American woman whose desires aren't routed through a white male character, right? If it's a straight relationship. And so to have that kind of representation, regardless.
So wait, but I guess what you're mm-hmm. saying is to see the Asian American man in the romantic lead role.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. Yeah, I mean, certainly we see more and more, I guess you'd call it kind of militant Asian American male representations, right? In other words, they're the people that perform martial arts, right? They're the ones that have the six-pack abs, et cetera, right? And so to have someone as much of a loser as Marcus.
Why is he a loser? For people who haven't seen it.
Well, I just think back to the line he has when he finally moves out of his father's place and he's leaving voicemail after voicemail for Sasha, trying to win her back. And he says he found a place, but it was, I think, suitably dumpy for him. So he's certainly someone that he's not aspiring like Sasha is as a character.
So in a way, this is also an Asian American take on the Slacker movie, another genre. At least as I see it.
For sure. And you have a lot more of those in indie film representations of Asian American men. So to have the combo, I guess, is something that's fairly new to me.
Tony, what about you?
Yeah, I agree with Anthony. Like, traditionally, you see these, you know, Asian men, they're not really, you know, three-dimensional characters. They kind of, like he said, plays martial arts or kind of the tough guy or the sullen actor. But here we have a guy that's just being a dude, you know? And as an Asian American, I kind of relate to that because, you know, there's been movies in the past where, like, you know, they talk about growing up Asian and all this stuff. But in this, I kind of just saw these two as growing up, you know, American with a nod to being Asian. And I kind of like that. I related it to it a lot more than, like, say, you know, Crazy Rich Asians last year that was kind of, you know, based out of more out of Asia and all that stuff. So I agree with Anthony. I really like this movie and just portraying him as a little bit more three-dimensional and then American, Asian-American men in general. Because if you, like, look at commercials and everything, it's always, like you said, there's, you know, an Asian woman, but she's always with a Caucasian man. And so this was nice to just see them as a couple for the first time.
Tony, you mentioned commercials, and do I remember right that you used to work in the advertising industry? And then, in fact, your job was to appeal to what was sort of a crassly understood minority demographic.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, you have to target where you have to target. You know, I hate saying that word, but it's kind of the reality of what it is. But, you know, they had to show diversity in this day and age. But sometimes, you know, by doing so, you kind of play to the you know, certain aspects that didn't make it very natural. And, you know, just to check off a box. And so that kind of made it weird. And a lot of times it was like, hey, we need some diversity in this or that, this picture, you know, we need this model of, you know, color or whatever. So let's just get that one person in a shot of like 20 people.
What do you think makes this movie allows it to go beyond just checking off that box, as you put it?
I think it was just time. And I think on Netflix, I think they take a risk. Like, I don't know. I would have loved to see how this movie would have done in a, you know, regular traditional theater release. And I don't know how it would have done. I know Ali Wong has built a audience base or a fan base that probably would have come out to see it. I know Randall Park, he's a solid, you know, comedic actor. He's done a lot of great stuff that he doesn't really get as much recognition as he should for. But, you know, Netflix, they're able to make this on that. And, you know, it proves to show that, you know, as an Asian American, we can make movies that are just, you know, typical movies versus has to be a story about, you know, a struggling immigrant or a kung fu master or whatever. It's just a, you know, a fun movie.
Well, we also have a movie critic here. Loie Lockerbie joins us from time to time on Central Standard. And Loie, before we really dig in more into this Asian American themes, put Always Be My Maybe in context as a rom-com.
It's pretty standard issue. You're talking about the formula. It very much follows the formula of people who, you know, they're friends and then they're in a relationship and then they split up and they're friends again and relationship again and they split up again and there's a big gesture and, you know, it's pretty standard in that regard. And, you know, the character development is always in service of how do we get from plot point A to plot point B rather than something that's really logical.
And we're all just waiting for them to get back together.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, and it doesn't really have to make sense. It just has to happen.
Yeah, the comedy part is sort of the ride. That's why we're on the ride to get where we know we're going from the beginning.
Yeah, and I think that part of it they do pretty well. I mean, the dialogue is very snappy and sharp. Ali Wong and Randall Park wrote a lot of it themselves. And they're friends. They've been friends for a long time in real life. And so you definitely get that camaraderie, that sense of camaraderie. Any scene where they're just walking down the street.
You can tell they're having fun together.
Yeah, yeah. When they're just walking down the street or hanging out in the kitchen or something, you know, you can really feel that sense of comfort level with each other. And they do a nice job with the supporting characters, too. I like her assistant is a really funny character. His girlfriend for a while, this kind of really freaky bohemian chick. And Marcus's dad is a terrific character. I honestly kind of wished the movie had been about him a lot of the time because it would have been a little different. And he's such a lovable, charming, wonderful character.
But the movie does pay homage to specific rom-coms. I've read that Ali Wong and Randall Park both are huge fans of When Harry Met Sally, and it shows. Like, there are moments where I feel like he's just totally channeling Billy Crystal.
Yeah, I think to some degree that's probably true. He winces a lot. I noticed that's like Randall Park's go-to facial expression. He's kind of got this wince on his face, like, oh, God. But, you know, they do make it their own. I mean, I wasn't thinking about When Harry Met Sally when I was watching it. So I guess that's a good thing in that they made it a little bit more distinctive that way.
I just want to jump in and ask if you think that the cheesy mainstream rom-com, whether it's a genre you like or not, is kind of part of the shared language of American culture.
Oh, sure. I mean, any genre that's very popular, and especially if it's referring back to other popular films, is going to have that appeal. You know, it's whether it's going to stand out in any other way than the fact that the leads are Asian American, because it really doesn't besides that. But, you know, in a way, that's progress, too. You know, the fact that you can have a traditional rom-com and the leads just happen to be Asian American and that's part of the story, but it's not the whole story. You know, then in a way, you know, that's progress too, because it doesn't have to be a huge deal or the whole centerpiece of the thing.
So. Yeah, they have called the movie, they have said that they were trying to do for Asian Americans what Boomerang did for African Americans in the 90s.
Fair enough, yeah.
And then, I mean, if you think about Love, Simon, what was that last year? I mean, that was a similar moment, you know, with gay kids in the teen romance genre. There had been plenty of art house movies portraying gay romance, but this was the teen movie, and in the end, the boy gets the boy, not the girl. Yeah. Otherwise, the formula is the same. Similarly important.
Yeah, although, you know, you mentioned Crazy Rich Asians, and I actually found that a better film in a lot of ways, and I think partly because it's based on a book, so you've got characters that are already established and a narrative that's already established. You're not trying to build it from scratch, and it's not quite as cliched as this, because I think with this, you know, they took these interesting characters and the funny dialogue and everything and then just layered it over a script that could have been written by a computer as far as the narrative part of it goes.
I don't know about the script being written by a computer. I think there's a lot of nuance in the script, and although it is following the formula, like it seems very 2019 to me in a lot of ways, including the style of humor. And also, like, gender dynamics, a lot of things seem very, like, shrewdly written to me.
Like?
Well, for example, there's a scene where Marcus and Sasha get in a big fight. And, well, we'll hear about that later. But the way that it is just a couple having a fight, but you have layers of different relationships with the past that they both share. You have different a sense that maybe part of what's going on is that the man being in the supportive role career-wise instead of the woman is part of what's on his mind. A lot of that nuance seems very 2019 and not computer-generated to me. But I digress.
Well, no, really, that's the conversation, isn't it?
Yeah, Anthony, jump back in here.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, one thing that I find, and maybe it's my training, I don't have a dog in the race in terms of, you know, how representative it is of rom-coms or if it kind of is a carbon copy in some ways. Kind of the way I think, I try to think about it just because I have to do it for promotion, right, is to kind of think about what kind of work does the film do. And, you know, one thing that was really intriguing to me is that both characters, Sasha and Marcus, have to fundamentally change in some ways. I think Marcus has to do a little bit more changing, more dramatic changing, right, in terms of changing his location by the end to be with Sasha. But the idea of home is really interesting to me. And I think one thing that we see in kind of, I call them stock representations of Asian Americans. You get it in literature, you get it in TV and film, is that the home is this kind of repressive place that needs to be escaped. And I think one thing that's interesting is that Sasha has no home. And that's something that's really, that bothers her throughout the film, right? No parents, no home. Whereas Marcus is perhaps a little too comfortable with the idea of home, and both of them have to relocate in some way by the end. I think it does some interesting work in terms of kind of my small corner of the world, Asian American studies, but I think also in terms of race studies as well, trying to think about what kinds of futures do these characters have, and if they're not the stock kind of going back home, what can they be together?
Okay, so let's get into some specific scenes.
Sure.
the story is these childhood friends hook up very awkwardly before Sasha goes to college, and then they stop speaking also very awkwardly. Sasha goes on to become a famous chef with lots of money. Marcus goes into a heating and cooling business with his dad. And I want to play the scene where Marcus and Sasha first meet up again as adults. Sasha has just come back to San Francisco to open a new restaurant with her friend Veronica because her fiancé has just suggested that they postpone their wedding and start seeing other people. Nobody really knows that part. In this scene, Marcus and his dad show up at Sasha's house in coveralls to install a new AC.
Look who's here. This is, and who's in the house? It's you. This is amazing.
Hi, Marcus.
Hi. Yeah. Hi, Sasha. Hi. Hello. Hi. What's up?
Long time.
Yes. Yes. Very long time. Very much so, indeed. But, you know, time passes and now it's like current modern. It's like we're here and this is great.
So I guess you're the air conditioning guy?
Oh, this? No. I just like the ease of a onesie.
Oh, okay.
You're back in town? I thought you moved to L.A.
I did. I'm just renting this house. I'm here for 2 months. We're opening a restaurant.
But you're renting, then why are you installing AC?
No way! Sasha Trent!
Mr. Kim, oh my God!
Oh, look at you!
You have not changed one bit. How do you not age?
I washed my face with shampoo. I can't believe I'm seeing you. We thought you'd never come back. You're like our own Asian Oprah.
Oh.
How much money do you have now?
He's serious.
Oh.
Oh, I just read you're getting married to that guy, your manager. Seems great. Older than I thought, but good. How old is he?
He's a very young 50. He does a lot of capoeira. He shops at Under Armour, and he has 57,000 followers on Instagram.
That was Ali Wong and Randall Park playing Sasha and Marcus in Always Be My Maybe. And Tony Vinn, I want to know what you hear in that scene. As a comic.
As a comic? Man, it was funny. I enjoyed this movie a lot. Just I thought the comedy was on point. Their timing was on, and I do agree that with you when you said that it's kind of written for the times, the humor in it is, you know, I mean, as a comic, I laugh. I'm very judgmental of comedy. A lot of rom-coms nowadays, it's like they kind of, you know, dialogue used to be so great, like in When Harry Met Sally and all those movies of the 90s. And
yeah, just those little moments.
Yeah, and nowadays they cheat it by just having, you know, physical comedy or, you know, just absurdist comedy just gets ridiculous. And just hearing, like, funny dialogue between the characters, like, I really appreciated that. And, you know, and just even throughout the whole movie, there's other scenes where they kind of just mention little things. Like, there's one scene where Ali mentions fish sauce ice cream. And, you know, that's just something that just made me laugh just because I could picture it and taste it in my head. And I just think the humor comes through from, you know, talented writers who kind of get it.
Let's go back to some of the culturally specific things in this dialogue that's just happened. I mean, there's a moment when Sasha's basically overcompensating for Mr. Kim mentioning that her fiancé's older than he thought he would be. And she starts talking about how many Instagram followers he has and where he shops. So I have, in one of the articles I've read about this movie, the author points out that there's a culturally specific element to that relating to something called saving face. I, as a white person, found this scene hilarious, but without getting that piece of it, like, at all. Anthony?
Yeah, I mean, if it's mentioned in the context of saving face, I think there's a certain kind of criticism that Marcus's father has of Sasha, right? In other words, he's a little bit older than what you expect, maybe not age appropriate. And so it seems like, I think your word overcompensating is perfect for what Sasha's doing, trying to show he's much younger than his years. I'm not sure what capoeira is. I think, I guess it's an exercise.
Brazilian martial arts, I think.
Yeah, oh, okay. And sort of trendy at the moment.
Right. So he's someone that is perhaps not only younger than his years in terms of what he does, but also is someone who's perhaps culturally viable, right? And so that kind of maybe compensates for his old age.
But what's your take on the portrayal of the parents in this? Because it struck me that Marcus's parents are very much against the kind of typical movie stereotype of Asian parents. You know, they're very warm, they're very supportive. His dad's hilarious. He gets in and dances with him and stuff like that. And if he is critical, it's that very kind of sideways. Whereas Sasha's parents, you know, they're workaholics. She never sees them. That's a little more stereotypical, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'd be interested in what Tony has to say as well about this. But, you know, one thing that you don't get a representation of, because it's really tough to represent, are absent parents, yeah. right? Parents that have to run mm-hmm. a store or a restaurant, and they're never home to see their kids. And so I think that kind of representation, especially by the end, where they're trying to make it up to Sasha so they don't pay, they don't ask for a discount at a restaurant and they order extra shrimp. That's something that I think, to Sasha at least, shows that they're on the right path because right. she's very begrudging. So, but yeah, it's a tough thing to represent. And I think one thing that we see with those kinds of absent parents, Asian American parents, usually in film, is that when they come home, they're domineering
right.
Or that they're abusive in some way.
But I do want to bring us back to the specific scenes.
Yeah.
Because we have a couple of more scenes that we want to dig into, and particularly with Anthony and Tony helping us pick up on some of the culturally specific pieces of them. Food is obviously central to this story. Sasha's a chef, but it's more than that. Anthony?
Yeah. I mean, it struck me that it's, you know, there's certainly something to be said about how much the movie tries to skewer hipsterism, right?
Yeah.
Or you know, I think we've started
savagely.
Talking about
that.
Yeah.
Some of the best scenes.
That's right. One thing that I'm always intrigued by is the turn in maybe the past 10 years about food becoming sentimental for people, right? In other words, it first started with the term comfort food, but then there's a line that Sasha has by the end. I want people, when they come to this restaurant in New York, to feel like they're coming home, I think. And so just kind of thinking about home as a theme in the movie is something that's really rich for me, especially with perhaps maybe what food represents for Sasha in the beginning and throughout most of her career. How she becomes successful as she serves a mainstream audience, kind of, you know, people that are into avant-garde cuisine, which you also see in the Keanu Reeves restaurant scene as well. But it becomes more a means to an end by the end, and it's something that serves people as opposed to financial interests for Sasha.
They have that really intense argument about elevated Asian cuisine.
That's right.
And Marcus takes offense to the idea that it needs to be elevated.
We are going to get to shortly. In a way, it was cool that food helps make this story so culturally specific. But does that teeter on the edge of an uncomfortable cliche?
Yes and no. I mean, it's something in Asian American films that you see quite a bit in terms of food being kind of the key cultural marker that I think a lot of white Americans especially know Asian Americans through. I think they are trying to do some different kind of work with food here, especially as we move towards the end of the film.
Well, it was Marcus's mom who taught Sasha how to cook, and I want to play that scene now. Marcus's family, the Kims, are Korean. Sasha's family is Vietnamese. So this is the conversation that unfolds as a young Sasha watches the Kims make dinner.
Look at that. Doesn't that look amazing?
It looks super amazing.
Kimchi jjigae is very simple. But that's what makes it so good. It's about using the best ingredients.
It smells so good, Mrs. Kim.
Sasha, I've told you a million times, call me Judy. And we Koreans use scissors for everything. Vegetables, noodles.
Our children.
You want to check?
Okay.
Look at you, you're a natural.
Thanks, Judy.
So, Tony, talk to me about what you hear in this scene.
Well, I remember when I was in college, I was using scissors to cut everything, and I had a non-Asian roommate, and he just was, you know, befuddled by that. He was just like, "Why are you using scissors to cut steak and all that?" And I'm just like, "I don't know. That's just what my mom uses, you know." I was like, "Why are you using a fork to eat rice?" but you know, and so when I hear that, it's just like when I watch that scene, I'm just like, okay, those are little nods that I'm familiar with, and it's just funny to me that they kind of put it in there, because you don't see that in a lot of the movies nowadays. Like in Crazy Rich Asian, yeah, with food, you know, you see that, you know, the trope scene of them kind of making dumplings together and all that stuff. And I think there might have been a quick scene of that in here. But, you know, this has felt more kind of just real. And it was like, all right, yeah, we all did this as a kid here.
The non-movie version.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And so it's just like, you know, when I watch that, I just relate to it a little. And it's funny to me.
Anthony?
Yeah, and even though Asian Americans have their own version of the thermos soup kids, I mean, there is something a little bit different, right? I remember, you know, I'm sure Tony has stories too. I had to bring salted fish fried rice to school. And, you know, the smells are different. And yeah. That's something that me and my Asian American friends would always talk about. It's like, and we tried to sit next to each other. So, and because of that pressure of not standing out, I guess, in an olfactory
shame.
Sense. Shame. There you go.
Later on, food becomes part of what establishes the two characters' differences in how they relate to their shared past. Marcus has been hanging out all this time, all these years, at the Cantonese restaurant where they went as kids. And he has actually learned Cantonese to get better service. Sasha thinks back on this place with open disdain.
That's right. And it seems like what Marcus is thinking when she says, why do I remember this food as always being so bad, is that from in his way of understanding Sasha is that she hated life and she wanted to escape where she was from. And so it seems like Marcus, being Korean-American, is quite aware that if you speak in someone's native tongue, they're going to be nice to you, especially the ladies at the dim sum place. And so I think it's really poignant when he gets a free order of shumai and the waitress puts it in front of Marcus forcefully. And
like actually, it's not for Sasha.
And Marcus agrees. And so in some ways, he puts in the work.
There's kind of a class thing going on there, too, I feel. Am I wrong in it, interpreting it that way, that maybe they've grown up in more of a working class environment than Sasha has gone on to be in her adult life, and that maybe he sees this as a snub?
Yeah, I mean, you know, for sure, Marcus is much more comfortable among a range of people and a range of classes. And it's something that Sasha is, she's almost orbiting Marcus or the earth that Marcus lives on, right? And so I think you see that especially with the Daniel Dae Kim character, the Keanu Reeves character, is that they're removed from a kind of reality because they're big on Instagram or they're big in the John Wick franchises. So they're not quite grounded like Marcus is.
I love about that scene, too, I'm sorry.
No,
what
no,
I love
no.
about that scene, too, is that, you know, a lot of my non-Asian friends, when they go with me to these Asian restaurants or these Chinese restaurants, whatever, for dim sum, yeah, the service, it seems a little, you know, harsh sometimes. And it kind of just reveals that, you know, that's just, you know, maybe it's just this connection that they don't have because of language or whatever that that they're not getting. And it also, what the scene does for me is, like, it shows that, you know, Asians aren't just, you know, we're just not one type of Asian. So Marcus is, you know, Korean-American, and he has to learn Cantonese to connect with this other, you know, group of people here. And it shows that, you know, just a broader aspect of who we are as Asian-Americans.
I want to play another food scene from later in the movie. By now, Sasha and Marcus are dating. Surprise, surprise. But Marcus still resents the way that Sasha caters to popular tastes and at what he sees as maybe capitalizing on their shared past. They've just been bickering over someone calling Sasha a celebrity chef, a word Marcus doesn't like. And in this scene, the argument heats up.
You know what other term I hate? Elevated Asian cuisine. Asian food isn't supposed to be elevated. It's supposed to be authentic. That's what you used to make with my mom. I don't know why you're doing this kind of stuff now.
So now you're saying my food isn't authentic?
It's not authentic. Asian food shouldn't be served in a shot glass. It should be served in a big ass bowl. You're just catering to rich white people.
Well, if you think I'm such a sellout, then why are you dating me?
Well, if you think I'm just a regular guy, then why are you dating me? Oh, I know. It's because you need someone to carry your purse.
I called you a regular guy as a compliment. Like you aren't caught up in all the bullshit.
The way you are?
Oh, right. Instead, you smoke weed every night because that's so much more noble.
God forbid someone relax in Sasha Tran's presence.
Don't shame me for going after things, Marcus.
Anthony, what do you hear here?
There's a certain... One thing that I was really appreciative of is that there's a certain critique or criticism of the the entrepreneurial striver that you tend to, a lot of people tend to associate with, especially immigrant groups, or groups that have a great proportion of immigrants in them. And so, you know, one thing that I find with Marcus's critique is that, you know, I think he's on point, but I also think that Sasha is not quite comfortable with where she might be in the future.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about Always Be My Maybe, starring Ali Wong and Randall Park. We'll be right back. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we've been talking about Always Be My Maybe, a romantic comedy that shows an intimate portrait of many different Asian American characters brought together by romance. But each character really tells his or her own specific story, making the movie maybe a little less susceptible to quaint generalizations about an incredibly varied range of experiences. I've been chatting with comic Tony Vinn, originally of Kansas City, now in LA, and Anthony Shifei Shu of UMKC's English department. We'll be bringing our movie critic back into this shortly, but for now I'm bringing producer Salisa Kalakal out of the booth to talk about the movie. I've been hearing her at work producing today's show, and I find her insights interesting. Salisa, good morning.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
I know you have just a few minutes. Tell us about yourself and how you relate to this movie.
Sure. So I'm Filipino-American. My parents immigrated to the U.S. from the Philippines, and I was born and raised in Los Angeles. And what I really like about the movie, it kind of subverts kind of the model minority stereotype. So the stereotype that Asian Americans are successful professionally and in school. With Sasha, she finds success, but not through the traditional routes of like being a doctor or a lawyer. She's a chef, and you don't really see that portrayal a lot. And then Marcus...
Yeah, she's like basically a rock star.
Basically. And then Marcus, he is more working class, and you don't see that kind of representation either. And the other thing is he didn't even go to college, and I think that is kind of, I don't want to say groundbreaking, but you don't see that kind of representation of Asian Americans in mainstream media. And another thing I really liked with Sasha is there's a stereotype of Asian women being kind of quiet, docile, like obedient, and she's really none of those things. In the movie, she gets loud, she gets mad, and she's not afraid to say what she thinks to Marcus, like we just heard in that clip. And I really like the portrayal of her character, and I think it shows that Asian Americans, Asian American men, and Asian American women are multidimensional. We're not one stock characters. We're not just one kind of person, but we, you know, fulfill a range of personalities and backgrounds.
Thank you, Salisa.
Thank
it has
you.
Been so much fun to overhear you working on this show. Thank you for coming out and sharing some of what I got to overhear with all of our listeners.
And thank you for having me.
Okay, that was Salisa Kalakal, everyone. Anthony, Tony, want to respond to anything Salisa just said? I'll start with you, Tony.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, just even this movie, I mean, you look at it, there's like no one speaks with an accent, you know? Even an older character like her or his dad, you know? Perfect English, perfect dialect. And that's kind of groundbreaking itself. And there's nothing wrong with someone speaking that way. I mean, certainly my parents, they speak with an accent. But here they chose to, you know, not go there. Just kind of, and it shows progress in the way Asians are viewed in movies. At least they're trying to get to that point now.
Anthony?
I totally agree. And, you know, one thing that's really interesting to me for a rom-com is that even though it's a stock genre, I think that there's... it's not necessarily a rom-com that skims the surface of the kinds of issues that are really important for Asian Americans. I think they take it at their core, and they bring them up, and they're important to work through in the rom-com field, I guess we could say, right? And so, you know, the kind of work, I think, or the kinds of ambitions that the film has are really interesting, as Salisa and Tony point out.
You know, there is this running gag about Sasha's parents in particular being cheap, although the relationship of the older characters with money and the younger characters with money, honestly, is recurring throughout the film. And I'm curious about, you know, you said there's something underneath it. There's like a core issue that is really important, even though it is a stock rom-com in some ways. Can you talk about what do you think is going on with money in this movie and with that running gag?
Yeah, well, I mean, you, when you played the clip earlier of Marcus's father saying that Sasha was the Asian Oprah, right, and asking how much money she had, it's there's a certain frankness about money that I think a lot of first generation and second generation immigrants or Asian Americans have. And it's not something to be embarrassed about. I know lots of people that will never talk about their salaries. I'm not sure why, right? But there's a kind of protectiveness about finances. But there's a frankness I think we see with, especially with the second generation Asian American father of Marcus and the first generation parents of Sasha.
So like the conversation between Sasha and Marcus tends to be very like symbolic. Like she's going to talk about where her fiance shops, and they're going to talk about how she dresses or how he dresses, whereas the parents are just going to be like, how much money do you have?
They expose everything. You know, Sasha's always talking about money, right? Even if it's about Instagram followers, right? Is my fiance an influencer, social media influencer? So they're talking about money, but they're talking about it in such a displaced
way. Or at least some kind of currency.
Yeah, absolutely.
Success. Yeah.
Definitely.
And Tony, yeah, jump in here.
Okay. No, go ahead, Anthony. I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, absolutely. So, I mean, if it's success, it's talked about in a different way, but it comes down to the core of money. So, in some ways, the conversation's boiling it down to what it's really about, which is cash.
Tony?
Yeah, I mean, that's the reality of it. I mean, my parents, you know, and my aunties and, you know, even my parents' friends, it's like, oh, what are you doing now? How much do you make? You know, and it's just the reality of it. They're always concerned about... maybe it's well-being. I don't know, but they definitely money is always on front of their mind, and saving money too, and so I don't, you know, where it might be okay. Is that a stereotype? Yeah, but it's kind of reality that I certainly live with. I'm not sure, Anthony. Maybe you live with that too.
Sure.
And so when I saw that, and it's how they express their love through that manner. That yes, here's a receipt. Look, we did pay for it. It's just hilarious to me. I don't.
I read a review in the New Yorker of Always Be My Maybe where the writer had really latched on to the opening scene that we heard earlier in the show where Sasha's a kid at home alone eating dinner in front of the TV. She's watching. I hadn't noticed this, but the TV show she's watching is Clarissa Explains It All. And the author of the review remembers watching Clarissa in her living room from a living room that looked more like Sasha's than Clarissa's. And seeing this tiny moment on screen was really meaningful to her. Just in thinking about the two worlds, she kind of lived in both of those worlds simultaneously. And she writes, to watch my own existential questions explored on screen, packaged into an old-fashioned rom-com, made this real in a way I once imagined only Clarissa Darling's living room could be. A private space unlocked and understood unequivocally as American. Anthony?
Yeah, you know, when I saw that scene, I immediately thought of Wayne Wong's Chan Is Missing, his, you know, great indie film from, I think, back in the 80s. And that was the same, I think that was almost the same set that we see in the film, which is related to, I guess that's a 90s teen show, right? And so there's a kind of, I guess, sameness that carries over, but we certainly get a sense that there are a lot of intimate conversations that are had there, or some kind of formative moments that we have with those, with the, especially the living room without family, right?
I want to bring our movie critic, Loey Lockerbie, back on before we have to go. Loey, how do you think hearing what our other guests have said today might influence the way you see this movie when you inevitably watch it a second time?
Well, you know, I actually agree with everything they're saying about what is specific to this film as far as the humor and the way it kind of flips stereotypes and, you know, just the chemistry between the leads. We didn't mention Keanu Reeves's cameo, which is just absolutely hilarious. You know, so it's always going to be a formulaic rom-com, but it does have those things to recommend it. And it is interesting, I mean, even not being Asian, just seeing it from, you know, from the perspective of knowing that they were very self-conscious about making this, you know, about second and third generation immigrant kids and their lives.
Loey Lockerbie, Tony Vinn, Anthony Shifeshu, thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Keep talking about Always Be My Maybe on Twitter. We are at KCURCST. Up next, Morel, mushrooms are tasty, but are they good flavors for beer and ice cream? We'll find out. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now, the glory of the Morel mushroom is not a secret. It's a delicacy that Midwesterners freak out about every spring. I am used to seeing them, though, in pastas or fried with saltines. I'm starting to see them in what, to me anyway, are unexpected places: ice cream and beer. David Friesen with us from Betty Ray's Ice Cream. Good morning.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You are serving Morel ice cream, I have noticed.
Yes, Morel ice cream.
We will get back to that. Chad Tillman, chef at Freshwater, is a Morel enthusiast who is a consultant on a new beer, a Morel beer from Crane Brewing.
That's
Hi, Chad.
Correct. Thank you.
Okay, so what gave you the idea to put this in a beer?
You know, it's just one of those things where you experiment it with so many different ways to cook them. And, you know, part of eating, you know, the concept of eating and drinking something together, it was just like, maybe we could make a beer using the mushrooms. And, you know, I started talking to a couple other guys and they loved the idea and they said, let's do it. So we collaborated. And
is there a tradition of mushroom based beers? I mean, this seems pretty nutty.
You know, I did do a little research and saw that there had been a few mushroom beers that had been made in the past. Nothing in the Kansas City area. So I think we're kind of trailblazers as far as that goes. Porcini mushroom beer. I've actually ran a couple of recipes that, you know, they use mushrooms in beer. So it was like, all right, if somebody else has done it, we're going to do it better.
Do you think it's good?
I've tasted it and it's absolutely what we thought it was going to be. So
how would you describe the taste?
So the taste that we were looking for was to just be able to recognize it. So we didn't want like this, you know, mushroom beer where you just tasted nothing but mushrooms. So we started off with what we call an English pub style ale. So it's kind of malty. The grain build inside of it is a biscuit grain. So it's got a very biscuity kind of aroma to it.
You've got my attention.
It definitely would play well with a mushroom. So we started off with a couple of different, you know, builds. The hops that we use were a noble hop. So everything that we prepared for this was, you know.
What is a noble hop?
Noble hop is a hop that is actually indicative of the English English varietals. So a little bit less on the hoppiness to it, but definitely played, you know, for a great note. We didn't want to overpower the maltiness or the hoppiness, so that mushroom could really, you know, at least shine through.
And David, what gave you the idea to create a Morel ice cream?
You know, I really couldn't say. It just kind of popped into my head. We always try to do things that reflect the area we're in. And like with the Joe's Barbecue ice cream that we do, and we've made a pawpaw ice cream. Everybody loves Morels. They're just so delicious and really, really special to this area. I knew a guy who had
That's
a lot
how
of
every
them.
Morel story yeah. starts. I know a guy.
There's a guy. And so we just got over $1,000 worth of Morels from him all at once. We just made a few batches in both shops, and it's really, really delicious. It's good.
I tried it. I took a sample. And I would describe this, you know, like the richness of syrup, like maple syrup?
Mm-hmm.
The richness of the Morel in the ice cream reminds me of like almost that syrupy kind of richness. And there's really like the first moment you taste it, you taste the sweetness. But then like a moment later, something more complicated sets in. Can you describe to me why I am having those experiences when I eat this ice cream?
Sure. Yeah. I'm not a food scientist, but I'll try.
Yes.
So we always try to make our flavors so that you do have different things at different moments. And so, you know, if something has a little bit of tartness or some savory to it, you can catch it at different times on the tongue or in the aftertaste. And for this one, we really just wanted that savory kind of umami quality that Morels have to be there.
Yes, that's that second thing I tasted, umami.
Yeah. And it's really nice, and it's not something you typically get in ice cream. I mean, we do a nice jasmine green tea ice cream that has a similar kind of quality to it. But with the Morels, it was so important that it would reflect what it was being made of. We only used fresh Morels, nothing else other than brown sugar butter, a little bit of salt, and our cream, and that's it. And the savory from the mushrooms kind of piggybacks on the kind of dairy fat that you get, and that really just carries it all the way through to the end. But I think up front you get that kind of sweetness of the butter and brown sugar, and it kind of just helps it all come together.
Well, so Chad, as both a chef and someone who has been described to me as a morel enthusiast, like, so you're like, do you forage and things like that?
I do. So actually this year I had reached out to some people who had asked me in the past, you know, if I'd be entertaining the thought of maybe taking them on some morel mushroom hunts. So one thing led to another. It was like one person, then all of a sudden I had interest with over 100 people that wanted to do these mushroom hunts. And so the logistics of it was crazy. But after it was all said and done, the cool part was is taking people out and teaching them how to find mushrooms. A lot of people think, well, you just go look for the mushrooms. Well, that's really not the case. The best thing to do is know your areas, know your times, temperatures of the ground. These are all things that we are looking for. Host trees play great parts in where you're going to be looking and finding mushrooms.
So. Are you in it for the hunt itself, or is there something about the quality of this mushroom that, like, demands you do it?
It's definitely a large part of it is the finding. There's an excitement. There is this, like, overwhelming feeling of, you know, I accomplished something. And then you get to eat them. I mean, it's like a perfect thing in the world. You know, you set out and looked for something, you found it, you've made it, and now you get to enjoy it. So
do you think taking these sort of culinary challenges and risks with the morel is an extension of that hunt in a way? Like, I'm going to not only hunt in the woods for these mushrooms at this particular time of year, but then I'm not going to just fry it. I'm going to figure out how to make this into a beer, or I'm going to figure out how to make this an ice cream.
Yes. I think that any way that you can prolong the mushroom season, because it's a short window. So we have like a month. So any way that we can make it last a little bit longer.
Ferment it or put it in a freezer. This makes total sense.
Absolutely. So, and you know, this is, you know, the concept is, you know, let's make a beer and then we can, you know, release it a little bit later. No one's eating morel mushrooms usually right around this time, unless you're, you know, from the north.
You know, David was just describing the umami quality of, well, all mushrooms, but the morel has a really rich taste.
It does.
And I wonder, when you set out to think about transforming that into a beer, how did you think about that? Because I don't normally think of beer as having those kinds of taste qualities in them. Umami beer, like, I don't put those together.
You know, it can be a tough, you know, trick. It's finding the right base beer. So it's not going to work with every other beer. I mean, you could do an IPA, which would be really bitter and very hoppy traditionally. Those notes of the mushroom would really have a hard time shining through. So it's really understanding different makes of grain builds, and that equates to different styles of beers.
Describe to me the day you've had when what the beer you want to crack open at the end of it is the morel beer.
I think it's more of a food beer. So I think there is a time for, you know, a cold, you know, crisp lager that's, you know, easy to drink right after you got the lawnmower. This is something I would really like to, you know, enjoy with, you know, maybe a bowl of morel mushroom bisque. So
mushroom with mushroom.
Mushroom on mushroom. Yes.
David, what about you? How would you describe, like, the meal that is concluded with the morel mushroom ice cream?
Well, I like to think of ice cream as something you go out and do. It's just, you know,
me
it's
too.
The fun experience. You know, you go out, you go to the shop, you see what's new. And I think it's just those nice little surprises, like, oh, morel ice cream. I didn't know
that. And if you have a kid, your kid is like ecstatic the second it is clear where you're going.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Chad was talking about the beers and it got me thinking. I mean, we do beer floats in our shop. I'd really love to try a scoop of the morel ice cream in the morel beer. I think that'd be amazing.
So wait, I mean, it just seems to me that that the audience for this is the person who has the pre-existing obsession with morel mushrooms. It's not like someone's standing in line and they're going to be like, I'd like the morel mushroom ice cream floating in morel mushroom beer. It's more like, as the morel-obsessed person, I'm like, yeah, they said morel twice.
Yeah, what's really cool about this, though, too, is that, like, we put the ice cream out. And so many people were saying, I've never gotten to try these mushrooms, or this is my first introduction to it. I've never even heard of them before. So it's, you know, just getting that out there and, you know, having fun with it.
A spoonful of sugar.
Exactly.
Well, our time is up, but this is super interesting. Thank you so much, Chad Tillman, David Friesen. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Crane Brewing has a Morel beer, and Betty Ray's Ice Cream has Morel ice cream if you want to try them for yourself. That's a wrap for today's show on KCUR's Central Standard. If you missed our conversation about Always Be My Maybe, you can catch it later today at kcur.org/centralstandard, along with this conversation about Morels in dessert and beer. kcur.org/centralstandard. While you're there, you can also access yesterday's election results conversation. We spoke with the New York Times reporter to put Kansas City's mayoral race in national perspective. Tomorrow, it's a portrait session with a couple that's investing in the East Side one building at a time, not using outside money, but blood, sweat, and tears. It's a portrait session with Daniel and Ebony Edwards tomorrow at 10. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Salisa Kalakal, Ann Kniggendorf, Chris Young, and intern Riley Kester. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.